Chapter 17. It is shown that no one can or need transfer all his rights to the sovereign power of the Hebrew Republic as it was during the lifetime of Moses and after his death till the foundation of the monarchy and of its excellence. Lastly, of the causes why the theocratic republic fell and why it could hardly have continued without dissension. The theory put forward in the last chapter of the universal rights of the sovereign power and of the natural rights of the individual transferred thereto, though it corresponds in many respects with actual practice, and though practice may be so arranged as to conform to it more and more, must nevertheless always remain in many respects purely ideal. No one can ever so utterly transfer to another his power, and consequently his rights, as to cease to be a man, nor can there ever be a power so sovereign that it can carry out every possible wish. It will always be vain to order a subject to hate what he believes brings him advantage, or to love what brings him loss, or not to be offended at insults, or not to wish to be free from fear, or 100 other things of the sort which necessarily follow from the laws of human nature. So much, I think, is abundantly shown by experience, for men have never so far ceded their power as to cease to be an object of fear to the rulers who receive such power and right, and dominions have always been in as much danger from their own subjects as from external enemies. If it were really the case that men could be deprived of their natural rights so utterly as never to have any further influence on affairs, except with the permission of the holders of sovereign right, it would then be possible to maintain with impunity the most violent tyranny, which I suppose no one would for an instant admit. We must therefore grant that every man retains some part of his right, independence of his own decision and no one else's. However, in order correctly to understand the extent of the sovereign's right and power, we must take notice that it does not cover only those actions to which it can compel men by fear, but absolutely every action which it can induce men to perform, for it is the fact of obedience, not the motive for obedience, which makes a man a subject. Whatever be the cause which leads a man to obey the commands of the sovereign, whether it be fear or hope, or love of his country, or any other emotion, the fact remains that the man takes counsel with himself, and nevertheless acts as his sovereign orders. We must not, therefore, assert that all actions resulting from a man's deliberation with himself are done in obedience to the rights of the individual rather than the sovereign. As a matter of fact, all actions spring from a man's deliberation with himself, whether the determining motive be love or fear of punishment. Therefore, either dominion does not exist and has no rights over its subjects, or else it extends over every instance in which it can prevail on men to decide to obey it. Consequently, every action which a subject performs in accordance with the commands of the sovereign, whether such actions spring from love or fear, or, as is more frequently the case, or from hope and fear together, or from reverence compounded of fear and admiration, or indeed any motive whatever, is performed in virtue of his submission to the sovereign and not in virtue of his own authority. This point is made still more clearly by the fact that obedience does not consist so much in the outward act as in the mental state of the person obeying, so that he is most under the dominion of another who with his whole heart determines to obey another's commands, and consequently the firmest dominion belongs to the sovereign who has most influence over the minds of his subjects. If those who are most feared possess the firmest dominion would belong to the subjects of a tyrant, for they are always greatly feared by their ruler. Furthermore, though it is impossible to govern the mind as completely as the tongue, nevertheless minds are to a certain extent under the control of the sovereign, for he can in many ways bring about that the greatest part of his subjects should follow his wishes in their beliefs, their loves, and their hates. Though such emotions do not arise in the express command of the sovereign, they often result, as experience shows, from the authority of his power and from his direction, in other words, in virtue of his right. We may therefore, without doing violence to our understanding, conceive men who follow the instigation of their sovereign in their beliefs, their loves, their hates, their contempt, and all other emotions whatsoever. Though the powers of government, as thus conceived, are sufficiently ample, they can never become large enough to execute every possible wish of their possessors. This, I think, I have already shown clearly enough. The method of forming a dominion which should prove lasting, I do not, as I have said, intend to discuss. But in order to arrive at the object I have in view, I will touch on the teaching of divine revelation to Moses in this respect, and we will consider the history and the success of the Jews, gathering therefrom what should be the chief concessions made by sovereigns to their subjects with a view to the security and increase of their dominion. That the preservation of a state chiefly depends on the subject's fidelity and constancy in carrying out the orders they receive is most clearly taught both by reason and experience. How subjects ought to be guided so as best to preserve their fidelity and virtue is not so obvious. All, both rulers and ruled, are men and prone to follow after their lusts. The fickle disposition of the multitude almost reduces those who have experience of it to despair, for it is governed solely by emotions, not by reason. It rushes headlong into every enterprise, and is easily corrupted, either by avarice or luxury. Everyone thinks himself omniscient, and wishes to fashion all things to his liking, judging a thing to be just or unjust, lawful or unlawful, according as he thinks it will bring him profit or loss. Vanity leads him to despise his equals, and refuse their guidance. Envy of superior fame or fortune, for such gifts are never equally distributed, leads him to desire and rejoice in his neighbor's downfall. I need not go through the whole list. Everyone knows already how much crime results from disgust at the present, desire for change, headlong anger, and contempt for poverty, and how men's minds are engrossed and kept in turmoil thereby. To guard against all these evils, and form a dominion where no room is left for deceit, to frame our institutions so that every man, whatever his disposition may prefer, public right to private advantage, this is the task and this the toil. Necessity is often the mother of invention, but she has never yet succeeded in framing a dominion that was in less danger from its own citizens than from open enemies, or whose rulers did not fear the latter less than the former. Witness the state of Rome, invincible by her enemies, but many times conquered and sorely oppressed by her own citizens, especially in the war between Vespasian and Vitellius. See Tacitus' Histories, Book 4, for a description of the pitiable state of the city. Alexander thought prestige abroad more easy to acquire than prestige at home, and believed that his greatness could be destroyed by his own followers. Fearing such a disaster, he thus addressed his friends, "Keep me safe from internal treachery and domestic plots, and I will front without fear the dangers of battle and of war." Philip was more secure in the battle array than in the theatre. He often escaped from the hands of the enemy. He could not escape from his own subjects. If you think over the deaths of kings, you will count up more who have died by the assassin than by the open foe. Q. Curtius, Chapter 6. For the sake of making themselves secure, kings who seized the throne in ancient times used to try to spread the idea that they were descended from the immortal gods, thinking that if their subjects and the rest of mankind did not look on them as equals, but believed them to be gods, they would willingly submit to their rule and obey their commands. Thus Augustus persuaded the Romans that he was descended from Aeneas, who was a son of Venus, and numbered among the gods. He wished himself to be worshipped in temples like the gods, with flamens and priests. Tacitus, Annals, Chapter 1, Verse 10. Alexander wished to be saluted as a son of Jupiter, not from motives of pride, but of policy, as he showed by his answer to the invective of Hermolaus. "It is almost laughable," said he, "that Hermolaus asked me to contradict Jupiter, by whose oracle I am recognized. Am I responsible for the answers of the gods? It offered me the name of son, acquiescence was by no means foreign to my present designs. Would that the Indians also would believe me to be a god. Wars are carried through by prestige. Falsehoods that are believed often gain the force of truth." Curtius, Chapter 8, Verse 8. In these few words he cleverly contrives to palm off a fiction on the ignorant, and at the same time hints at the motive for the deception. Cleon, in his speech persuading the Macedonians to obey their king, adopted a similar device. For after going through the praises of Alexander with admiration, and recalling his merits, he proceeds, "The Persians are not only pious, but prudent in worshipping their kings as gods, for kingship is a shield of public safety." And he ends thus, "I myself, when the king enters a banquet hall, should prostrate my body on the ground, other men should do the like, especially those who are wise." Curtius, Chapter 8, Verse 65. However, the Macedonians were more prudent. Indeed, it is only complete barbarians who can be so openly cajoled, and can suffer themselves to be turned from subjects into slaves without interests of their own. Others, notwithstanding, have been able more easily to spread the belief that kingship is sacred, and place the part of God on the earth, that it has been instituted by God, not by the suffrage and consent of men. and that it is preserved and guarded by divine special providence and aid. Similar fictions have been promulgated by monarchs with the object of strengthening their dominion, but these I will pass over, and in order to arrive at my main purpose, will merely recall and discuss the teaching on the subject of divine revelation to Moses in ancient times. We have said in chapter 5 that after the Hebrews came up out of Egypt, they were not bound by the law and right of any other nation, but were at liberty to institute any new rites at their pleasure and to occupy whatever territory they chose. After their liberation from the intolerable bondage of the Egyptians, they were bound by no covenant to any man, and therefore every man entered into his natural right and was free to retain it or to give it up and transfer it to another. Being then in the state of nature, they followed the advice of Moses, in whom they chiefly trusted, and decided to transfer their right to no human being, but only to God. Without further delay, they all, with one voice, promised to obey all the commands of the deity, and to acknowledge no right that he did not proclaim as such by prophetic revelation. This promise, or transference of right to God, was effected in the same manner as we have conceived it to have been in ordinary societies, when men agree to divest themselves of their natural rights. It is in fact in virtue of a set covenant as an oath, see Exodus chapter 34 verse 7, that the Jews freely, and not under compulsion or threats, surrendered their rights and transferred them to God. Moreover, in order that this covenant might be ratified and settled, and might be free from all suspicion of deceit, God did not enter into it till the Jews had had experience of his wonderful power, by which alone they had been, or could be, preserved in a state of prosperity. Exodus chapter 19 verses 4 and 5. It is because they believed that nothing but God's power could preserve them, that they surrendered to God the natural power of self-preservation, which they formerly, perhaps, thought they possessed, and consequently they surrendered at the same time all their natural right. God alone, therefore, held dominion over the Hebrews, whose state was in virtue of the covenant called God's kingdom, and God was said to be their king. Consequently, the enemies of the Jews were said to be the enemies of God, and the citizens who tried to seize the dominion were guilty of treason against God. And lastly, the laws of the state were called the laws and commandments of God. Thus in the Hebrew state, the civil and religious authority, each consisting solely of obedience to God, were one and the same. The dogmas of religion were not precepts, but laws and ordinances. Piety was regarded as the same as loyalty, impiety as the same as disaffection. Every one who fell away from religion ceased to be a citizen, and was on that ground alone accounted an enemy. Those who died for the sake of religion were held to have died for their country. In fact, between civil and religious law and right, there was no distinction whatever. For this reason, the government could be called a theocracy, inasmuch as the citizens were not bound by anything save the revelations of God. However, this state of things existed rather in theory than in practice, for it will appear from what we are about to say, that the Hebrews, as a matter of fact, retained absolutely in their own hands the right of sovereignty. This is shown by the method and plan by which the government was carried on, as I will now explain. Inasmuch as the Hebrews did not transfer their rights to any other person, but, as in a democracy, all surrendered their rights equally and cried out with one voice, "Whatsoever God shall speak, no mediator or mouthpiece being named, that we will do," it follows that all were equally bound by the covenant, and that all had an equal right to consult the deity, to accept and to interpret his laws, so that all had an exactly equal share in the government. Thus at first they all approached God together, so that they might learn his commands. But in this first salutation they were thoroughly terrified, and so astounded to hear God speaking, that they thought their last hour was at hand. Full of fear, therefore, they went afresh to Moses and said, "Lo, we have heard God speaking in the fire, and there is no cause why we should wish to die. Surely this great fire will consume us. If we hear again the voice of God, we shall surely die. Thou therefore go near and hear all the words of our God, and thou, not God, shall speak with us. All that God shall tell us, that we will hearken to and perform." Thus they clearly abrogated their former covenant, and absolutely transferred to Moses their right to consult God and interpret his commands, for they do not here promise obedience to all that God shall tell them, but to all that God shall tell Moses. See Deuteronomy chapter 5 after the Decalogue and chapter 18 verses 15 and 16. Moses therefore remained the sole promulgator and interpreter of the divine laws, and consequently also the sovereign judge, who could not be arraigned himself, and who acted among the Hebrews the part of God. In other words, held the sovereign kingship. He alone had the right to consult God, to give the divine answers to the people, and to see that they were carried out. I say he alone, for if anyone during the life of Moses was desirous of preaching anything in the name of the Lord, he was, even if a true prophet, considered guilty, and a usurper of the sovereign right. Numbers chapter 11, verse 28. We may here notice that though the people had elected Moses, they could not rightfully elect Moses' successor, for having transferred to Moses their right of consulting God, and absolutely promised to regard him as a divine oracle, they had plainly forfeited the whole of their right, and were bound to accept as chosen by God anyone proclaimed by Moses as his successor. If Moses had so chosen his successor, who like him would wield the sole right of government, possessing the sole right of consulting God, and consequently of making and abrogating laws, of deciding on peace or war, of sending ambassadors, appointing judges, in fact, discharging all the functions of a sovereign, the state would have become simply a monarchy, only differing from other monarchies in the fact that the latter are, or should be, carried on in accordance with God's decree, unknown even to the monarch, whereas the Hebrew monarch would have been the only person to whom the decree was revealed. A difference which increases rather than diminishes the monarch's authority. As far as the people in both cases are concerned, each would be equally subject and equally ignorant of the divine decree, for each would be dependent on the monarch's words and would learn from him alone what was lawful or unlawful. Nor would the fact that the people believed that the monarch was only issuing commands in accordance with God's decree revealed to him make it less in subjection, but rather more. However, Moses elected no such successor, but left the dominion to those who came after him in a condition which could not be called a popular government, nor an aristocracy, nor a monarchy, but a theocracy. For the right of interpreting laws was vested in one man, while the right and power of administering the state, according to the laws thus interpreted, was vested in another man. See Numbers chapter 27, verse 21. In order that the question may be thoroughly understood, I will duly set forth the administration of the whole state. First, the people were commanded to build a tabernacle, which should be, as it were, the dwelling of God, that is, of the sovereign authority of the state. This tabernacle was to be erected at the cost of the whole people, not of one man, in order that the place where God was consulted might be public property. The Levites were chosen as courtiers and administrators of this royal abode, while Aaron, the brother of Moses, was chosen to be their chief and second, as it were, to God their king, being succeeded in the office by his legitimate sons. He, as the nearest to God, was a sovereign interpreter of the divine laws. He communicated the answers of the divine oracle to the people, and entreated God's favor for them. If, in addition to these privileges, he had possessed the right of ruling, he would have been neither more or less than an absolute monarch. But in respect to government, he was only a private citizen. The whole tribe of Levi was so completely divested of governing rights that it did not even take its share with the others in the partition of territory. Moses provided for its support by inspiring the common people with great reverence for it as the only tribe dedicated to God. Further, the army formed from the remaining 12 tribes was commanded to invade the land of Canaan, to divide it into 12 portions and to distribute it among the tribes by lot. For this task, 12 captains were chosen, one from every tribe, and were together with Joshua and Eleazar, the high priest, empowered to divide the land into 12 equal parts and distribute it by lot. Joshua was chosen for the chief command of the army, inasmuch as none but he had the right to consult God in emergencies, not like Moses, alone in his tent or in the tabernacle, but through the high priest, to whom only the answers of God were revealed. Furthermore, he was empowered to execute and cause the people to obey God's commands, transmitted through the high priest, to find and to make use of means of carrying them out, to choose as many army captains as he liked, to make whatever choice he thought best, to send ambassadors in his own name, and in short, to have the entire control of the war. To his office there was no rightful successor. Indeed, the post was only filled by the direct order of the deity on occasions of public emergency. In ordinary times, all the management of peace and war was vested in the captains of the tribes, as I will shortly point out. Lastly, all men between the ages of 20 and 60 were ordered to bear arms and form a citizen army, owing allegiance not to its general-in-chief, nor to the high priest, but to religion and to God. The army or the hosts were called the army of God or the hosts of God. For this reason, God was called by the Hebrews the God of armies, and the Ark of the Covenant was borne in the midst of the army in important battles, when the safety or destruction of the whole people hung upon the issue, so that the people might, as it were, see their king among them, and put forth all their strength. From these directions left by Moses to his successors, we plainly see that he chose administrators rather than despots to come after him, for he invested no one with the power of consulting God. Where he liked and alone, consequently, no one had the power possessed by himself of ordaining and abrogating laws, of deciding on war or peace, of choosing men to fill offices both religious and secular. All these are the prerogative of a sovereign. The high priest indeed had the right of interpreting laws and communicating the answers of God, but he could not do so when he liked, as Moses could, but only when he was asked by the general-in-chief of the army, the council, or some similar authority. The general-in-chief and the council could consult God when they liked, but could only receive his answers through his high priest, so that the utterances of God, as reported by the high priest, were not decrees, as they were when reported by Moses, but only answers. They were accepted by Joshua and the council, and only then had the force of commands and decrees. The high priest, both in the case of Aaron and of his son Eleazar, was chosen by Moses, nor had anyone, after Moses' death, a right to elect to the office which became hereditary. The general-in-chief of the army was also chosen by Moses, and assumed his functions in virtue of the commands, not of the high priest, but of Moses. Indeed, after the death of Joshua, the high priest did not appoint anyone in his place, and the captains did not consult God afresh about a general-in-chief, but each retained Joshua's power in respect to the contingent of his own tribe, and all retained it collectively, in respect to the whole army. There seems to have been no need of a general-in-chief, except when they were obliged to unite their forces against a common enemy. This occurred most frequently during the time of Joshua, when they had no fixed dwelling place, and possessed all things in common. After all the tribes had gained their territories by right of conquest, and had divided their allotted gains, they became separated, having no longer their possessions in common, so that the need for a single commander ceased, for the different tribes should be considered rather in the light of the confederated states than of bodies of fellow citizens. In respect to their God and their religion, they were fellow citizens, but in respect to the rights which one possessed with regard to another, they were only confederated. They were in fact in much the same position, if one accepts the temple common to all, as the United States of the Netherlands. The division of property held in common is only another phrase for the possession of a share by each of the owners singly, and the surrender by the others of their rights over such share. This is why Moses elected captains of the tribes, namely, that when the dominion was divided, each might take care of his own part, consulting God through the high priest on the affairs of his tribe, ruling over his army, building and fortifying cities, appointing judges, attacking the enemies of his own dominion, and having complete control over all civil and military affairs. He was not bound to acknowledge any superior judge save God, or a prophet whom God should expressly send. If he departed from the worship of God, the rest of the tribes did not arraign him as a subject, but attacked him as an enemy. Of this we have examples in scriptures. When Joshua was dead, the children of Israel, not a fresh general-in-chief, consulted God, it being decided that the tribe of Judah should be the first to attack its enemies. The tribe in question contracted a single alliance with the tribe of Simeon for uniting their forces and attacking their common enemy, the rest of the tribes not being included in the alliance. Judges chapter 1, verses 1, 2, and 3. Each tribe separately made war against its own enemies and, according to its pleasure, received them as subjects or allies, though it had been commanded not to spare them on any conditions, but to destroy them utterly. Such disobedience met with reproof from the rest of the tribes, but did not cause the offending tribe to be arraigned. It was not considered a sufficient reason for proclaiming a civil war or interfering in one another's affairs. But when the tribe of Benjamin offended against the others, and so loosened the bonds of peace that none of the confederated tribes could find refuge within its borders, they attacked it as an enemy, and gaining the victory over it after three battles, put to death both guilty and innocent, according to the laws of war, an act which they subsequently bewailed with tardy repentance. These examples plainly confirm what we have said concerning the rights of each tribe. Perhaps we shall be asked who elected the successors to the captains of each tribe. On this point I can gather no positive information in Scripture. But I conjecture that as the tribes were divided into families, each headed by its senior member, the senior of all these heads of families succeeded by right to the office of captain, for Moses chose from among these seniors his 70 coadjutors, who formed with himself the supreme council. Those who administered the government after the death of Joshua were called elders. An elder is a very common Hebrew expression in the sense of judge, as I suppose everyone knows. However, it is not very important for us to make up our minds on this point. It is enough to have shown that after the death of Moses, no one wielded all the power of a sovereign, as affairs were not all managed by one man, nor by a single council, nor by the popular vote, but partly by one tribe, partly by the rest in equal shares. It is most evident that the government, after the death of Moses, was neither monarchic, nor aristocratic, nor popular, but as we have said, theocratic. The reasons for applying this name are, 1. Because the royal seat of government was the temple, and in respect to it alone, as we have shown, all the tribes were fellow citizens. 2. Because all the people owed allegiance to God, their supreme judge, to whom only they had promised implicit obedience in all things. 3. Because the general-in-chief or dictator, when there was need of such, was elected by none save God alone. This was expressly commanded by Moses in the name of God, Deuteronomy chapter 19, verse 15, and witnessed by the actual choice of Gideon, of Samson, and of Samuel. Wherefrom we may conclude that the other faithful leaders were chosen in the same manner, though it is not expressly told us. These preliminaries being stated, it is now time to inquire the effects of forming a dominion on this plan, and to see whether it so effectually kept within bounds both rulers and ruled, that the former were never tyrannical, and the latter never rebellious. Those who administer or possess governing power always try to surround their high-handed actions with a cloak of legality, and to persuade the people that they act from good motives. This they are easily able to effect when they are the sole interpreters of the law, for it is evident that they are thus able to assume a far greater freedom to carry out their wishes and desires than if the interpretation of the law is vested in someone else, or if the laws were so self-evident that no one could be in doubt as to their meaning. We thus see that the power of evil doing was greatly curtailed for the Hebrew captains by the fact that the whole interpretation of the law was vested in the Levites, Deuteronomy chapter 21 verse 5, who on their part had no share in the government and depended for all their support and consideration on a correct interpretation of the laws entrusted to them. Moreover, the whole people was commanded to come together at a certain place every 7 years and be instructed in the law by the high priest. Further, each individual was bidden to read the book of the law through and through continually with scrupulous care. Deuteronomy chapter 31 verses 9 and chapter 6 verse 7. The captains were thus for their own sakes bound to take great care to administer everything according to the laws laid down and well known to all, if they wished to be held in high honor by the people, who would regard them as the administrators of God's dominion and as God's vice-regents. Otherwise, they could not have escaped all the virulence of theological hatred. There was another very important check on the unbridled license of the captains, in the fact that the army was formed from the whole body of the citizens between the ages of 20 and 60, without exception, and that the captains were not able to hire any foreign soldiery. This, I say, was very important, for it is well known that princes can oppress their peoples with the single aid of the soldiery in their pay. While there is nothing more formidable to them than the freedom of citizen soldiers who have established the freedom and glory of their country by their valor, their toil, and their blood. Thus Alexander, when he was about to make war on Darius a second time, after hearing the advice of Parmenio, did not chide him who gave the advice, but Polysperchon, who was standing by. For as Curtius says, chapter 4, verse 13, he did not venture to reproach Parmenio again after having shortly before reproved him too sharply. This freedom of the Macedonians, which he so dreaded, he was not able to subdue till after the number of captives enlisted in the army surpassed that of his own people. Then, but not till then, he gave rein to his anger, so long checked by the independence of his chief fellow countrymen. If this independence of citizen soldiers can restrain the princes of ordinary states, who are wont to usurp the whole glory of victories, it must have been still more effectual against the Hebrew captains, whose soldiers were fighting not for the glory of a prince, but for the glory of God, and who did not go forth to battle till the divine assent had been given. We must also remember that the Hebrew captains were associated only by the bonds of religion. Therefore, if any one of them had transgressed and begun to violate the divine right, he might have been treated by the rest as an enemy and lawfully subdued. An additional check may be found in the fear of a new prophet arising, for if a man of unblemished life could show by certain signs that he was really a prophet, he ipso facto obtained the sovereign right to rule, which was given to him, as to Moses formerly, in the name of God, as revealed to himself alone, not merely through the high priest, as in the case of the captains. There is no doubt that such an one would easily be able to enlist an oppressed people in his cause, and by trifling signs persuade them of anything he wished. On the other hand, if affairs were well ordered, the captain would be able to make provision in time, that the prophet should be submitted to his approval, and be examined whether he were really of unblemished life, and possessed indisputable signs of his mission. Also, whether the teaching he proposed to set forth in the name of the Lord agreed with received doctrines and the general laws of the country. If his credentials were insufficient, or his doctrines new, he could lawfully be put to death, or else received on the captain's sole responsibility and authority. Again, the captains were not superior to the others in nobility or birth, but only administer the government in virtue of their age and personal qualities. Lastly, neither captains nor army had any reason for preferring war to peace. The army, as we have stated, consisted entirely of citizens, so that affairs were managed by the same persons both in peace and war. The man who was a soldier in the camp was a citizen in the marketplace. He who was a leader in the camp was a judge in the law courts. He who was a general in the camp was a ruler in the state. Thus, no one could desire war for its own sake, but only for the sake of preserving peace and liberty. Possibly, the captains avoided change as far as possible, so as not to be obliged to consult the high priest and submit to the indignity of standing in his presence. So much for the precautions for keeping the captains within bounds. We must now look for the restraints upon the people. These, however, are very clearly indicated in the very groundwork of the social fabric. Anyone who gives the subject the slightest attention will see that the state was so ordered as to inspire the most ardent patriotism in the hearts of the citizens, so that the latter would be very hard to persuade to betray their country, and be ready to endure anything rather than submit to a foreign yoke. After they had transferred their right to God, they thought that their kingdom belonged to God, and that they themselves were God's children. Other nations they looked upon as God's enemies, and regarded with intense hatred, which they took to be piety. See Psalm 139, verses 21 and 22. Nothing would have been more abhorrent to them than swearing allegiance to a foreigner and promising him obedience, nor could they conceive any greater or more execrable crime than the betrayal of their country, the kingdom of the God whom they adored. It was considered wicked for anyone to settle outside of the country, inasmuch as the worship of God by which they were bound could not be carried on elsewhere. Their own land alone was considered holy, the rest of the earth unclean and profane. David, who was forced to live in exile, complained before Saul as follows: "But if they be the children of men who have stirred thee up against me, cursed be they before the Lord, for they have driven me out this day from abiding in the inheritance of the Lord, saying, Go serve other gods." 1 Samuel chapter 26, verse 19. For the same reason, no citizen, as we should especially remark, was ever sent into exile. He who sinned was liable to punishment, but not to disgrace. Thus the love of Hebrews for their country was not only patriotism, but also piety, and was cherished and nurtured by daily rites, till, like their hatred of other nations, it must have passed into their nature. Their daily worship was not only different from that of other nations, as it might well be, considering that they were a peculiar people and entirely apart from the rest. It was absolutely contrary. Such daily reprobation naturally gave rise to a lasting hatred, deeply implanted in the heart. For of all hatreds, none is more deep and tenacious than that which springs from extreme devoutness or piety, and is itself cherished as pious. Nor was a general cause lacking for inflaming such hatred more and more, inasmuch as it was reciprocated, the surrounding nations regarding the Jews with a hatred just as intense. How great was the effect of all these causes, namely freedom from man's dominion, devotion to their country, absolute rights over all other men, a hatred not only permitted but pious, a contempt for their fellow men, the singularity of their customs and religious rites, the effect, I repeat, of all these causes in strengthening the hearts of the Jews to bear all things for their country with extraordinary constancy and valor, will at once be discerned by reason and attested by experience. Never, so long as the city was standing, could they endure to remain under foreign dominion, and therefore they called Jerusalem a rebellious city. Ezra chapter 4, verse 12. Their state after its re-establishment, which was a mere shadow of the first, for the high priest had usurped the rights of the tribal captains, was with great difficulty destroyed by the Romans, as Tacitus bears witness. Histories, chapter 2, verse 4. Vespasian had closed the war against the Jews, abandoning the siege of Jerusalem as an enterprise difficult and arduous, rather from the character of the people and the obstinacy of their superstition than from the strength left to the besieged for meeting their necessities. But besides these characteristics, which are merely ascribed by an individual opinion, there was one feature peculiar to this state and of great importance in retaining the affections of the citizens and checking all thoughts of desertion or abandonment of the country, namely self-interest, the strength and life of all human action. This was peculiarly engaged in the Hebrew state, for nowhere else did citizens possess their goods so securely as did the subjects of this community, for the latter possessed as large a share in the land and the fields as did their chiefs, and were owners of their plots of ground in perpetuity. For if any man was compelled by poverty to sell his farm or his pasture, he received it back again intact at the year of Jubilee. There were other similar enactments against the possibility of alienating real property. Again, poverty was nowhere more endurable than in a country where duty towards one's neighbor, that is, one's fellow citizen, was practiced with the utmost piety, as a means of gaining the favor of God the King. Thus the Hebrew citizens would nowhere be so well off as in their own country. Outside its limits they met with nothing but loss and disgrace. The following considerations were of weight, not only in keeping them at home, but also in preventing civil war and removing causes of strife. No one was bound to serve as equal, but only to serve God, while charity and love towards fellow citizens was accounted the highest piety. This last feeling was not a little fostered by the general hatred with which they regarded foreign nations and were regarded by them. Furthermore, the strict discipline of obedience in which they were brought up was a very important factor, for they were bound to carry on all their actions according to the set rules of the law. A man might not plough when he liked, but only at certain times, in certain years, and with one sort of beast at a time. So too he might only sow and reap in a certain method and season. In fact, his whole life was one long school of obedience. See chapter 5 on the use of ceremonies. Such a habit was thus engendered that conformity seemed freedom instead of servitude, and men desired what was commanded rather than what was forbidden. This result was not a little aided by the fact that the people were bound, at certain seasons of the year, to give themselves up to rest and rejoicing, not for their own pleasure, but in order that they might worship God cheerfully. Three times in the year they feasted before the Lord. On the seventh day of every week they were bidden to abstain from all work and to rest. Besides these, there were other occasions when innocent rejoicing and feasting were not only allowed but enjoined. I do not think any better means of influencing men's minds could be devised, for there is no more powerful attraction than joy springing from devotion, a mixture of admiration and love. It was not easy to be wearied by constant repetition, for the rites on the various festivals were varied and recurred seldom. We may add the deep reverence for the temple, which all most religiously fostered, on account of the peculiar rites and duties that they were obliged to perform before approaching thither. Even now, Jews cannot read without horror of the crimes of Manasseh, who dared to place an idol in the temple. The laws scrupulously preserved in the inmost sanctuary were objects of equal reverence to the people. Popular reports and misconceptions were, therefore, very little to be feared in this quarter, for no one dared decide on sacred matters, but all felt bound to obey, without consulting their reason, all the commands given by the answers of God received in the temple, and all the laws which God had ordained. I think I have now explained clearly, though briefly, the main feature of the Hebrew Commonwealth. I must now inquire into the causes which led the people so often to fall away from the law, which brought about their frequent subjection, and finally the complete destruction of their dominion. Perhaps I shall be told that it sprang from their hardness of heart. But this is childish, for why should this people be more hard of heart than others? Was it by nature? But nature forms individuals, not peoples. The latter are only distinguishable by the difference of their language, their customs, and their laws. While from the two last, that is, customs and laws, it may arise that they have a peculiar disposition, a peculiar manner of life, and peculiar prejudices. If then the Hebrews were harder of heart than other nations, the fault lay with their laws or customs. This is certainly true, in the sense that, if God had wished their dominion to be more lasting, he would have given them other rights and laws, and would have instituted a different form of government. We can therefore only say that their God was angry with them, not only, as Jeremiah says, from the building of the city, but even from the founding of their laws. This is borne witness to by Ezekiel, chapter 20, verse 25. Therefore I gave them also statutes that were not good, and judgments whereby they should not live. And I polluted them in their own gifts, in that they caused to pass through the fire all that openeth the womb, that I might make them desolate to the end, that they might know that I am the Lord. In order that we may understand these words and the destruction of the Hebrew commonwealth, we must bear in mind that it had at first been intended to entrust the whole duties of the priesthood to the firstborn and not to the Levites. See Numbers chapter 8 verse 17. It was only when all the tribes except the Levites worshipped the golden calf that the firstborn were rejected and defiled, and the Levites chosen in their stead. Deuteronomy chapter 10 verse 8. When I reflect on this change, I feel disposed to break forth with the words of Tacitus. God's object at that time was not the safety of the Jews, but vengeance. I am greatly astonished that the celestial mind was so inflamed with anger that it ordained laws which always are supposed to promote the honor, well-being, and security of a people, with the purpose of vengeance, for the sake of punishment, so that the laws do not seem so much laws, that is, the safeguard of the people, as pains and penalties. The gifts which the people were obliged to bestow on the Levites and priests, the redemption of the firstborn, the poll tax due to the Levites, the privilege possessed by the latter of the sole performance of sacred rites, all these, I say, were a continual reproach to the people, a continual reminder of their defilement and rejection. Moreover, we may be sure that the Levites were forever heaping reproaches upon them, for among so many thousands there must have been many importunate dabblers in theology. Hence the people got into the way of watching the acts of the Levites, who were but human, of accusing the whole body of the faults of one member, and continually murmuring. Besides this, there was the obligation to keep in idleness men hateful to them, and connected by no ties of blood. Especially would this seem grievous when provisions were dear. What wonder, then, if in times of peace, when striking miracles had ceased, and no man of paramount authority were forthcoming, the irritable and greedy temper of the people began to wax cold, and at length to fall away from a worship which, though divine, was also humiliating and even hostile, and to seek after something fresh. Or can we be surprised that the captains, who always adopt the popular course, in order to gain the sovereign power for themselves by enlisting the sympathies of the people and alienating the high priest, should have yielded to their demands and introduced a new worship? If the state had been formed according to the original intention, the rights and honor of all the tribes would have been equal, and everything would have rested on a firm basis. Who is there who would willingly violate the religious rights of his kindred? What could a man desire more than to support his own brothers and parents, thus fulfilling the duties of religion? Who would not rejoice in being taught by them the interpretation of the laws, and receiving through them the answers of God? The tribes would thus have been united by a far closer bond if all alike had possessed a right to the priesthood. All danger would have been obviated if the choice of the Levites had not been dictated by anger and revenge. But as we have said, the Hebrews had offended their God, who, as Ezekiel says, polluted them in their own gifts by rejecting all that openeth the womb, so that he might destroy them. This passage is also confirmed by their history. As soon as the people in the wilderness began to live in ease and plenty, certain men of no mean birth began to rebel against the choice of the Levites, and to make it a cause for believing that Moses had not acted by the commands of God, but for his own good pleasure, inasmuch as he had chosen his own tribe before all the rest, and had bestowed the high priesthood in perpetuity of his own brother. They, therefore, stirred up a tumult, and came to him, crying out that all men were equally sacred, and that he had exalted himself above his fellows wrongfully. Moses was not able to pacify them with reasons, but with the intervention of a miracle, in proof of the faith, they all perished. A fresh sedition then arose among the whole people, who believed that their champions had not been put to death by the judgment of God, but by the device of Moses. After a great slaughter or pestilence, the rising subsided from inanition, but in such a manner that all preferred death to life under such conditions. We should rather say that sedition ceased than that harmony was re-established. This is witnessed by Scripture, Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 21, where God, after predicting to Moses that the people after his death will fall away from the divine worship, speaks thus, "For I know their imagination which they go about, even now before I have brought them into the land which I swear, and a little while after, Chapter 31, verse 27, Moses says, "For I know thy rebellion and thy stiff neck. Behold, while I am yet alive with you this day, ye have been rebellious against the Lord, and how much more after my death?" Indeed, it happened according to his words, as we all know. Great changes, extreme license, luxury, and hardness of heart grew up. Things went from bad to worse, till at last the people, after being frequently conquered, came to an open rupture with the divine right, and wished for a mortal king, so that the seat of government might be the court instead of the temple, and that the tribes might remain fellow citizens in respect to their king, instead of in respect to divine right and the high priesthood. The vast material for new seditions was thus produced, eventually resulting in the ruin of the entire state. Kings are above all things jealous of a precarious rule, and can in no wise brook a dominion within their own. The first monarchs, being chosen from the ranks of private citizens, were content with the amount of dignity to which they had risen. But their sons, who obtained the throne by right of inheritance, began gradually to introduce changes, so as to get all the sovereign rights into their own hands. This they were generally unable to accomplish, so long as the right of legislation did not rest with them, but with the high priest, who kept the laws in the sanctuary, and interpreted them to the people. The kings were thus bound to obey the laws as much as were the subjects, and were unable to abrogate them, or to ordain new laws of equal authority. Moreover, they were prevented by the Levites from administering the affairs of religion, king and subject being alike unclean. Lastly, the whole safety of their dominion depended on the will of one man, if that man appeared to be a prophet, and of this they had seen an example, namely, how completely Samuel had been able to command Saul, and how easily, because of a single disobedience, he had been able to transfer the right of sovereignty to David. Thus the kings found a dominion within their own and wielded a precarious sovereignty. In order to surmount these difficulties, they allowed other temples to be dedicated to the gods, so that there might be no further need of consulting the Levites. They also sought out many who prophesied in the name of God, so that they might have creatures of their own to oppose the true prophets. However, in spite of all their attempts, they never attained their end. For the prophets, prepared against every emergency, waited for a favorable opportunity, such as the beginning of a new reign, which is always precarious, while the memory of the previous reign remains green. At these times, they could easily pronounce by divine authority that the king was tyrannical, and could produce a champion of distinguished virtue to vindicate the divine right, and lawfully to claim dominion or a share in it. Still, not even so could the prophets effect much. They could indeed remove a tyrant, but there were reasons which prevented them from doing more than setting up, at a great cost of civil bloodshed, another tyrant in his stead. Of discords and civil wars there was no end, for the causes for the violation of divine right remained always the same, and could only be removed by a complete remodeling of the state. We have now seen how religion was introduced into the Hebrew commonwealth, and how the dominion might have lasted forever, if the just wrath of the lawgiver had allowed it. As this was impossible, it was bound in time to perish. I am now speaking only of the first commonwealth, for the second was a mere shadow of the first, inasmuch as the people were bound by the rights of the Persians to whom they were subject. After the restoration of freedom, the high priest usurped the rights of the secular chiefs, and thus obtained absolute dominion. The priests were inflamed with an intense desire to wield the powers of the sovereignty and the high priesthood at the same time. I have, therefore, no need to speak further of the second commonwealth. Whether the first, in so far as we deem it to have been durable, is capable of imitation, and whether it would be pious to copy it as far as possible, will appear from what follows. I wish only to draw attention as a crowning conclusion to the principle indicated already, namely, that it is evident from what we have stated in this chapter, that the divine right or the right of religion originates in a compact. Without such compact, none but natural rights exist. The Hebrews were not bound by their religion to evince any pious care for other nations not included in the compact, but only for their fellow citizens.